This is Specific Objects, Talks on Art in the Catskills, and I'm your host, Miriam Atkin. Today I have here with me in the studio writer, curator, and musician Erica Dawn Lyle, and I will share a brief bio for her. Erica Dawn Lyle is a writer, curator, experimental musician, and cultural instigator. The former touring guitar player for Bikini Kill, as a solo performer, Lyle has released musical collaborations with Kim Gordon, The Raincoats, Bernadette Mayer, Kathleen Hanna, Brontez Purcell, and many more. And she performs in the improv free jazz activist duo My Kawara with drummer Marshall Trammell. Lyle is the author of Streetopia and On the Lower Frequencies, A Secret History of the City, and has written for Art Forum, Art in America, Freeze, and NPR's This American Life. Her most recent book is The Knight of Cups. So we're going to jump right in and play side A from Erica's new solo LP called On Fire, just out from Feeding Tube and Half a Million Records.
Ooh. is our righteous sonic.
Thank you.
So this is a reimagination of a Van Halen song. Why Van Halen?
Hi, Miriam. Thanks for having me on. It's great to talk about Van Halen in the Catskills with you. As a small child, Van Halen was very important to me. I wouldn't claim anything more than that. I wouldn't say, like, I play guitar because of Eddie Van Halen or anything like that. I have a partner who's an Angelina who is sort of my David Lee Roth. and would be so thrilled to be called that. A tiny Jewish rock star. And we used to drive around LA together and blast Van Halen. But I think what happened with this really was just that I was listening to this song On Fire one time a couple of years ago. And I was just sort of like laughing to myself about the lyrics. And I was like, you know, like this could become some kind of rad like trans girl anthem, because like people are like so obsessed with trans people. And it just seemed like what everybody in the news wants to talk about all the time is what trans people are doing. And you know, we're here, we're hot, but they also want to like burn us at the stake, you know? So it's like On Fire. It's a great thing. So I was kind of joking with myself and I was like, I'm going to go mess around with it while I'm like rehearsing, you know, like while I'm doing my improv stuff, I'll go play the song and see if I can come up with anything. And I thought it might be fun, but I wasn't really thinking about it that seriously. And then what happened is, was the day that I actually was going to start, I woke up and there was wildfire smoke that had completely choked out the sun. The sky was like, it was one of those days where the sky was like pretty black in the summer of 23, in the early summer of 23. And I was like, oh wow, On Fire. Okay. And so I went to play and I was like singing the song again and again all day, trying to like think about what like an arrangement might be if I was going to sing it. And so it started to have like a really heavy vibe for me. It's like every time I would go outside to take a break or something, and then I would like see the sky. I don't know if you have this thing, like when the sky gets full of smoke like that, I always feel like, you know, a lot of people take pictures of the sun through the smoke, but I always, I almost feel like ashamed to look at the sky on those days. You know, there's something about it where it's like, you know, the sense of like being a part of what's been done to the natural world is so great. So the song started that day to like have this other kind of possibility for me to work with. Like there is something definitely like rock and roll inside of it that's like, fuck yeah, like on fire, sexy. But then there's also this other like kind of more somber element that was coming through. And so I was like, all right, maybe I can work with this. So I ended up kind of like just, you know, since I do improv, I was just kind of improvising with the song live for a couple years off and on. And then ended up coming up with like an arrangement that I decided I wanted to record.
Yeah. So your relationship to it kind of changed based on this horrific cosmic coincidence where the fire as a symbol changed into a different kind of symbol.
Yeah, that happened kind of in real time for me. I don't know, it's funny, I'm a little self-conscious about it because like, okay, so like I had my first record was called Greatest Hits, and like it was just like I just made a fake cover that had like listed all these like radio rock songs from my childhood. You know, it was like Jessie's Girl and Surrender and you know, Hit Me With Your Best Shot, whatever. Great music, but like I didn't actually like try to like, I wasn't actually trying to like play those songs. It was not in any way part of the material. It was just like, I just wanted to like package my experimental music in a different way than normal. Like, cause I kind of come from rock and roll more, like a rock background and punk rock. And I didn't want to be like, you know, like, you know, Meditations on the Guitar, Volume 1, you know, yeah. That style, you know, like the kind of typical. And then I was messing around with a song called Paranoid 2, which was related to the Paranoid Black Sabbath song. And I played it live. And do you know Rob Sheffield? He was this music writer. He's this really sweet guy. Rob was there. And then he was like, oh, okay, so that's your thing. You like take these songs and you rework them. And I was like, no, that's not the thing. You know. But then now I have this record that's actually doing that. But that is what happened with the song. And the thing is with the song too, it's like I played it for a couple of years and it kind of continued happening. Like the it's like, I don't know, it's actually just, it's kind of been like had this like heavy element the whole time. There's this really uncanny way that the song has like tapped into other things that were happening. It's like in the beginning of 2024, I was in Mexico for a month. I kind of went to some spot that was really cheap just to like do writing and work on some stuff. And I knew I wanted to record the song in Los Angeles when I got back to the US. So I was thinking about the final arrangements for the vocal part. And so one night, like I think it was the whatever night it was like the full moon and Virgo that night, I went to the beach and was singing the song all night. And this, yeah, I don't know, this is in that time, like, do you remember when, like, early 24 was, like, probably, maybe you're not on social media much, but there was, like, a time when a lot of us would, like, would only post things about Gaza, you know? Mm-hmm. And so, like, I feel like I was kind of in this group of people who's like, we basically were like entirely shadow banned and like we were only posting information that only each other saw at some point. You know, it's like my Instagram views went from like hundreds and hundreds down to like 75, you know, because I was only posting about Gaza and we were all like just like really trying so hard to bear witness to what was going on there. And it felt like there was this kind of collective effort to, by doing this, even though we knew it wasn't going to like necessarily change the situation, it was a way to almost like collaboratively hold on to a sense of shared reality, you know, like of what the truth really is. And I think a lot of us who are like writers or musicians were also thinking about what is the value of witness or like or what more could we offer with our work or that kind of thing. There was just a lot of like kind of agonizing over it at the time because the protest efforts were being squashed so intensely. And at this time I was like, I went and was singing the song one night and then I woke up the next day and it was the day that Aaron Bushnell had self-immolated. And that, it was just such gutting news to wake up to. But then I was also like, that's insane that I just spent like 10 hours singing on fire, like, and then woke up to this, you know? And then I went to LA and recorded the record in my friend Vice Cooler's studio. And then his studio burned down like a month later. And then I made time to go back to LA and finish up some stuff this year, and of course the whole city burned right before I showed up. I'm not trying to say it has any connection, I'm just saying it's like it's been right in the pocket of like it's ended up like this project has been like really closely linked to all kinds of like really heavy stuff.
Yeah, there was something I guess quite literally in the air that you might have just picked up on when you decided to do a treatment of this particular song.
You know, it was like DLR's hand was on my shoulder and he's like I'm done, you know, but you got to carry this one for me, girl.
Yeah, well, along those lines, this gesture of transforming a rock anthem, I thought of the free jazz tradition of messing with widely recognizable melodies that have strong cultural significance. And Albert Eiler's invocation of the Marseillaise came to mind. This, you know, the French national anthem, and which is also a kind of revolutionary rallying call. I guess I'm just wondering if that if that analog makes sense to you. And another way of asking that would be, what's interesting to you about that anthem in particular? Does it feel like a kind of national anthem?
No, I can't even make a stretch like that. I do think that the tradition you're talking about is something that I'm interested in for sure. Like I was interviewed by by a podcaster from LA last week, and you know, even as an Angelino, he was like not fully on board with Van Halen, you know. You know, and then he called Pasadena the suburbs, which I thought was really funny. But anyway, it sounds like I'm making fun of Randy. Sorry. Hi, Randy. So I don't think that Van Halen, I don't think that this particular song is that kind of anthem or anything at all.
Yeah.
No, I mean, like, I don't know. It might have a certain utility as like, I don't know, like recently I was driving, I came upon like Millerton, like at night in down in Dutchess County, I was driving, and it was Friday night, and Led Zeppelin was on my radio, and I was like, oh, so I rolled down the windows and just drove around the town for a while blasting Led Zeppelin because it was Friday night. I felt like it was like my role to like bring that to a small town. But I don't think Van Halen has that. What I will say is that I think it's more like actually motivated by it's more like a Kathy Acker idea or something. I think it's more like inhabiting a text in that way. You know, like, because I was working with the Black Sabbath Paranoid record mm-hmm. in a more serious way, because I was interested, and I'm sort of come back to that a little bit, but again, I'm self-conscious about it because I don't want it to be like my thing of Rob standing over my shoulder. That's your thing. But I was thinking about Black Sabbath. I was thinking about Doom as an affect. Hmm. In this moment, and like, you know, the, you know, what kind of like utility there is and kind of probing Doom, because Doom can often like be on the line with like melodrama, you know, or like it can be comic, you know. So I was like, is there something, like, things are so doomed right now that like, is there something funny about how doomed it is? You know, can we work with this? Hmm. So I was trying to work with the Black Sabbath stuff a little bit for that, but yeah, I think maybe the tradition would be more like that kind of, from that like literary perspective.
So you mentioned Kathy Acker, like, I'm guessing that you're referring to the way that she takes different cultural signals and twists them and deforms them. Is that what you mean?
Yeah, it's like she would take some found text and like find something else inside of it and put, and then insert herself inside of it as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you talk about Doom. I think like my experience of listening to this piece, there is a sense of doom. There's also something incantatory and ritualistic about it to me, and I think it has something to do with the sonic experience. There's a lot of this sort of substrate of something rhythmic or repetitive. At one point it's the maracas, and then later you have this sort of three note melody that repeats over and over, and then on top of it there's just this wildness, this sort of wailing voice, and that combination of like the unrestrained, unruly voice on top of that sort of driving, repetitive ground, it felt very incantatory to me. And then I watched the video that you made of it. It really does feel like a ritual. And I guess it's kind of easy for me to say. It's like, of course, a fire is a kind of cleansing ritual, but do you see it as ritualistic? And if so, what's the purpose of the ritual?
Thank you for that observation. And I appreciate that. Not a lot of folks have heard this yet. So it's great for me to hear back what people are thinking about it. You know, I do a lot of work with ritual in like my private spiritual practice in different ways. And so I do think that that element is present in the stuff that I do. I think that when you're working with rituals, I think oftentimes there might be an intention, but it's also an experiment in a way. So it's like, it's not always like, this is going to do this or something, you know? But I think that like, once I had recorded it and had more of a definite sense of like what the motifs of it were that were going to be in it, I quit playing it like last year in 2024 after I recorded it. I didn't play it. Excuse me. But then this year I was going to go back to LA and do a couple things on it. So I had a Midwest tour and I played the song every night. Which is just to say that I sang the lyrics, the music being improv always ended up being pretty different. But, and I think that like on that trip, the ritual aspect of it in some way was just grounding, you know, there's like a, to me, there's like the narrator of the song has a certain power. And so I was kind of maybe just like trying to ground into that power for myself. You mentioned the video. This week, Miriam happens to know that I spent this week working on a video for the other track on Fire, which is side two. And that had maybe a different ritual purpose, making the video, because we're recording this on September the 19th, which I woke up today to to learn that the director of the FBI is would like to declare transgender people to be domestic terrorists. So this has been a very difficult like week for trans people in this country. And I probably was not going to make a video, but then I decided to work on a video to kind of work through my feelings around this a little bit. And so what I did was I made a big fire and I just had an idea to see if it would work, but I had a couple of takes with just like a single camera fixed location oneer kind of shot, like a one shot video. And shot it from an angle that I knew it would glitch out the phone super hard and make it look like I was consumed in flames for most of the video. And so then I just like danced and sang with the video, though I couldn't, and it's unfortunate, I didn't get to do as much dancing as I'd like because I was trying to stay in the fire frame. So it's not a super awesome dance video in a way for me, but the fire stuff came out in a way that I really liked. And so doing that was a way to kind of just like sit with the intensity of this moment. Yeah, you might be the only person. I don't know. I don't know if anyone's seen it yet. Like I just got it done at like 6 a.m. last night. Yeah.
Well, will it be publicly viewable?
Yeah, this record comes out on October the 3rd. At a record release show in New York City that I'm very excited about. If you're listening and you can get to the city, or if you're listening online, I will be performing at Intercom in Ridgewood, which is a wonderful venue that this fellow John Pugh from old punk days of mine started. And we'll be playing with some really cool folks. Zoe Amba and Gabby Fluke Mogul are doing a duo. I'm really excited about that. And my friend Ricky, who performs under the name Yada, will be there with their wonderful cello player Zili. And Smiling Beth, who's a really cool young queer performance artist and dancer and noise performance artist, will be playing. And so that day, the record's currently available for pre-order, but the record will be out, the video will be out, everything will be out on October 3rd.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to WGXC 90.7 FM, and this is Specific Objects, Talks on Art in the Catskills. I'm your host, Miriam Atkin, and today I'm talking with writer, curator, and musician Erica Dawn Lyle. So now we'll turn to Erica's writing. with Erica reading from a series of poem letters that were part of an improvised dance collaboration with local artist Hannah van der Kolk. So, Erica, I invite you to read from those pieces, and then we can talk about the context of the work.
Dear Hannah, I've been trying to write to you, but when I look back at what I've written to you about my tours and the progress with my book and all the projects that I'm working on, then everything that I've written to you just seems kind of insane. Which is just to say that I do not think it is any longer possible to truthfully present to others the kind of stable performance of self expected from the epistolary form. How can I be so sure I can say what I mean? And by what standard can we measure meaning now, after all that's happened? How can I be sure that I mean what I say? No, it's every word for itself now. My body begins to look for other ways to connect. I am in Mexico City and you are in New Orleans, but I am dancing here with you today in my tiny room. And as we begin, the earth gently shakes, 10 seconds, 20, and then so do I, getting to know the contours, this room, what's available to me, this new body, these thoughts, impulses, the inscrutable plant in the corner by the lone window, surveys a desolate interior courtyard, but dances like a green fire in the trembly earthquake afternoon. It's sweaty in this room. I take off my shirt and get to know the wall. It feels cool to my cheek. I press harder, these new boobs offering soft pillows, and it is sweet, feeling, determined, pressing face first into the walls, the corner, my corners, pink nails scrape white walls. The light the plant is reaching for, this too is mine. Untranslatable experience. Dear Hannah, when performance of a stable self becomes impossible, one's self could always go on strike. As I move today, I begin to locate my body within these four walls, and myself, where? I am somewhere else. Information. Walking along the shifting line where the sea becomes shore, all the charged negative particles there seeking to connect. So, are you like Shadow Band 2? Dancing along the shore at twilight. Dear Hannah, I'm dancing today into this uneasy, false peace along fault lines. I'm still thinking about the other day, the ever-present possibility of the intervention of earthquakes and gender transition. So much new in dance that I would like to make my body do, and there is so much I cannot. Repeat, fail, repeat to fail. Is there an opportunity here too, within this kind of unintentional rupture? The failure of the body to perform its assigned tasks. So many people watching children blown apart on their phones, asking, how am I supposed to get through the day? I dance into failure and wonder what kind of future becomes possible if we all quit trying at once to just get through this day. Dear Hannah, the legislature of my home state of Florida today introduced a bill to make transgender legally non-existent, and here in my small room, I notice I am very interested in the wall. Again, I press against it, seeking maneuverability, what might still be possible where flesh meets plaster. Can I find yet more room to move? The bed is enormous and empty and swallows half the room, an emptiness doubled by the mirror, and I'm moving around all in there, quite lost. I wonder if this has ever happened to you, the inability to anymore imagine your body somewhere or in the future. When I can't do so, I start over. I return to the wall. I press firmly and steadily against it, but it's no use. My future self is squirting out the sides, and I only think of the state of Florida, its performance, if you will, of its own stability, rising seas, erosion, the softening of its instantly recognizable shape on the map. There is so much land there that now identifies as water, and in the white wall, I see at last this vision shining like the full moon over Miami, the milky light bathing streets of water. It does not come from the sky, but up through the ground, the shifting curves of the shoreline, the redistribution of fat, The only way out is through. Dear Hannah, I'm moving today at the waterfall and investigating the tension between improvisation and repetition. I do not want the word dancing to describe specific movements or actions, but instead this process of discovery, which is all just to say I had sex with a tree again. I was on the bridge over the stream, and there was a sexy birch tree at one end, and I started dancing suggestively for the tree, really getting into it, not moving towards it deliberately, but kind of sideways, looking over my shoulder. No direct steps, just letting my body's momentum and its rocking motion move me slowly like a syrup or a sap in the direction of my lover. The anticipation was very hot. It took like 5 full minutes to get there. And then when I reached it, I put my arms around it, feeling its barrel chest, resting my cheek against its bark. And I just got flooded with this warm, gooey, green and gold feeling spreading over and around me. And I came massively. I tried to imagine my love for the trees spreading out from this orgasm to envelop it. I noticed the feeling was amber, honey-colored, and I felt the gold mixing with the pine-green energy from the tree. And it was so delightful that I actually had to stop and lay down on the bridge and just look up at the sky and breathe. And breathe. Dear Hannah, it's high summer, a mixed bag. Here are some things that I Googled today. What are these wildflowers? How can a trans woman breastfeed? Is this the airport massacre and Juan Perón? And is there a name for this? The way we develop an obsessive fear of something terrible that might happen in the future as a way to pretend that the feared event has not actually already happened because we currently lack the capacity to manage the pain of that truth? On a road near my house in the country, I have two neighbors. One is a sausage maker, the other runs an animal sanctuary. They both keep pigs in pens. Their respective animals graze and grunt just across the road from each other. I often try to imagine the conversation between these neighbors. I mean the pigs. Today, as I tend to you and dance, I remember the roots of this psychic practice in the time of lockdown, at a time when being together was largely off limits. The way people then sublimated their desire to touch each other into this ritual task of making masks. I see you now in that clearing in the forest where we sometimes dance, barefoot on the springy moss together, and I consider the intimacy of this gesture, lovingly making by hand something for a stranger to wear on their face for protection. The governor wants now to make them illegal to wear in public. I consider the relationship of collective memory to the process of mourning, the refusal to mourn as a way to deny change, to stop the flow of time. This blockage in my hips, it is grief, and the fear lives here, at my waistline. There is continuity even when it cannot be imagined, the transmutation of old energies into new forms. I dance as our society's refusal to mourn now returns to us as this refusal to love. Dear Hannah, I'm thinking about our conversation, about our fears, the inadequacy of this practice. There's a genocide, and we are dancing, trying to feel. But what other preparation could there be? Cecilia says, maximum fragility versus maximum strength. We must fight on our own terrain. Dancing under this full moon, working with the Virgo Pisces axis, I consider the tension between organization and dissolution. I think about the historic links between improvised dance and the kinds of trainings that the Freedom Riders undertook, how to move, how to respond, how to orient towards an opponent, how to trust a comrade, how to take a fall. Can we imagine a preparation for fascism animated by this tension between the score and improvisation, between strategy and sensation? Okay, and then this is the last one. I made this when Steve Paxton died, the dancer. Hannah and I did like a little like writing tribute to him together, and so I made this out of lines from some of Paxton's public speaking, and I rearranged them. Dear Hannah, excuse me. Dear Hannah, Instead of skin, I'm hanging by my skin, a visual surface all over my body, result of so many changes in orientation in a short time, converting a sudden accident into several equal and opposite reactions, the light of consciousness into a controlled descent. We believed we could learn to handle the forces if we could turn off the skin, so gravity is masked, empires and children falling at the same velocity, and what is required by the senses is appalling, the equation between performance and experience, ignoring what it feels to be the apple. The sense of smell is leaving, sense of sight now rigidly controlled, muscular or mental, I am experiencing subtle falls, an assessment of things to come, my chances of survival, which part of my body. An empire's mass is greater in proportion to structural strength. A body could endure for decades its commitment to something that isn't happening. I have little memory, no residuals of past judgments or my way to safety, the passage from up to down. At these speeds, I cannot think. Contracting energies overpower. I fall transparent.
So I'm wondering if you can say a bit about the collaborative project out of which these poems arose.
Sure. Hannah is somewhat locally known in the Hudson Valley area. Is like a dancer and movement performer. And in the height of the early period of the lockdown and COVID, they came up with this practice where they started doing what they called psychic practice with various friends and collaborators, where they would arrange to dance together at a specific time from their remote location, and then they would write together afterwards. And so we started doing that stuff. And then that led us to, we started doing a real life improv collaboration. At first, like, we were doing something where they were dancing and I was playing drums in a pretty like non-related way. Like, they weren't really dancing to beats that I was making. But, and then at some point we decided that the drums were like not necessary anymore. And so we just started dancing together and singing together and doing that more. And that's been more successful. But, and we still do get together and dance. We got together actually 2 weeks ago and had a really nice dance. But, they've been like moving to a new town. I haven't seen them as much. So we do a lot more psychic these days. And so in that regard, like, we'll like do a quick check-in or something and be like, here's what's on my mind today. And then we'll like sort of dance and think about it together and then do this writing. Hmm. And so this stuff is derived from that kind of ritual practice.
Hmm. Yeah. I was really struck by, maybe it was the first or second poem that you read, that sensation of enclosure, the room and the walls. And there was something really beautiful to me about this kind of opening up along with or despite, you know, like the four walls of a room.
Mm-hmm.
That exploration. I guess it was one of those things that I sort of vicariously experienced.
Hmm. Thanks for that observation. Yeah, I think at the time that was written, like, there was in the beginning of that Mexico trip that I mentioned earlier, I was in Mexico City. And so we did some dancing at that time. And I just really had this tiny space. Whereas often we'll meet up in the country somewhere or something like that. So, you know, I mean, that was actually like kind of fun part of this practice, is trying to find places like when traveling. One time they were doing a performance in Troy and I did psychic with them at the same time. They were having a hard time because of a breakup and they asked if I would join them. So they were performing on stage in Troy while I was dancing in the Arroyo Seco in Pasadena, which is a suburb of Los Angeles. Sorry. Sorry, I'm having like a private LA joke. But, So yeah, like that kind of like cut finding of trying to find like a psychogeographic space to do this dance is sometimes fun. But I think that like that, what you're observing, I think is there was a lot of the writing I was doing at that time, I think was about it. There's something about being trans that for me is like about like this idea of instantiating freedom. You know, it's like, there's an internal voyage that like is not apparent to people who haven't experienced it. And so there's something liberatory that happens internally that's like a kind of a private spiritual revelation that feels like achieving a kind of freedom, even if you're like inside of a certain, literally inside of a walled enclosure. Yeah.
So these are poems, and the medium of poetry is language, and yet they invoke all these intimacies with nonverbal beings in nature, like you mentioned, wildflowers, fireflies, trees, pigs, the moon. So I was wondering, as a writer, do you see something uniquely important in these nonverbal intimacies?
Oh, that's a really nice question. I do see that as, I do see that as being really important. And even if one is not like in a beautiful outdoor kind of rural location like we are where the studio is right now, but if you're in the city, I don't know, like I often find like orienting towards like a tree in a neighborhood or towards maybe like a bird that I see on a particular day or something can be really helpful for me. It can be, I think it's really good to be open to the natural world that persists inside of the urban. And yeah.
I wanted to ask about a specific line, and that's in, I think, the second to last poem that you just read. So I'm really intrigued by this line. Especially because I do have a particular interest in improvised dance and some experience with it. And yeah, this line really got me thinking. So the line is, I think about the historic links between improvised dance and the kinds of trainings the Freedom Riders undertook. So I'm wondering if you could maybe say more about those links that you were thinking about.
Yeah, thank you for asking that. I think that, I mean, in some ways that poem addresses like a sense of like soul searching that Hannah and I sometimes have, where like, you know, a lot of this material is very particular to the beginning of 24. So it is really in the thick of that kind of observation of Gaza time that I mentioned earlier. And I think there's a thing where we're like, you know, like, here we are doing this dance practice. What is like, how is this helpful right now? Like, shouldn't we be, you know, dot, 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 you know, there's all these ideas about what preparation are, or what like meaningful protest is. And I think that when we kind of interrogate each other and ourselves about this a lot, and I think that what we've learned that we really feel is important is that from improvisation, there is, there's a lot of skills that do feel like important around preparation for, the kind of difficult, times that we're in right now. Whether it's not just around like the ability to move and think on your feet, but I think also just like being really present with figuring out how to be present in your body and to be, to not be so reactive is important. But then maybe in a more literal answer to your question, you know, the Freedom Riders and also a lot of subsequent generations of activists have gone to these kinds of trainings where they like literally like undertake physical training, in like hand-to-hand combat and how to take a blow from the police, especially those who are using nonviolent tactics. This is like a very, very common skill set for people to like learn how to protect oneself and engage in those situations where you're not supposed to fight back. But, and then a lot of those exercises are about,
It's a good sound.
See, I can't stop improvising. A lot of those exercises are about developing these group frameworks for being in stressful situations together. And I think actually, you know, yeah, like a lot of work that Hannah does is like, Hannah does a lot of like, movement training with like groups of people where they'll like gather together for a couple weeks and do all kinds of experimental things. And then people come out of it often feeling really close together. And so I do think that there is like a lot of utility in, pursuing these kinds of activities, in terms of like mental and physical preparation. I mean, also in general, I mean, I think in the form of improvisation is, I'm a little bit of a reformed leftist, you know, I no longer believe that there's like a certain programmatic, you know, idea that like, that's going to like, someone's going to write a book that says here's how we're going to win the revolution or something, you know? Or that a certain philosophy that we like strictly adhere to is going to carry the day. You know, I do think that improvisation and moving intuitively into the transformations that are required of us in this moment are going to be the way that we're going to get through it. Yeah,
I've found that those collective improvisations, navigating the movements of one's body in a collective space with other bodies, it feels very essential to like gaining some understanding of simply how to be in the world in a way that's entirely individualized and acknowledges difference in a way that's just so much more radical than speech can get at. This is something I've experienced, is like avant-garde dance and improvisation feels to me the best kind of social therapy, because everyone has this opportunity to kind of feel and see what they are in relation to other people. And there's a lot of risk in it, just like there is in life, you know, and possibilities of physical interactions that are unpleasant. And it's just like, it feels like this very primordial way of figuring out how to be with that very essential part of being human. It's like being around other people in space, you know?
Totally. And there's so much that, I mean, there's so much that comes through, I think, somatically when you can get in touch with your, and really be present with yourself and others in that way. That's like, that is in a way like about like unlearning a kind of restriction that's, you know, comes from just from moving through a society. You know? So I think that like learning that kind of orientation with other people can be, yeah, it can be really revelatory for oneself, for sure.
So we are about out of time, and to close the show, well, I wanted to ask what you have coming up, and you already mentioned you have this show in Ridgewood, right? But this is the beginning of a larger tour, is that right?
Yeah, I'm going to be out for most of October and November, a little bit of December.
Okay, and for people who want to access your work, how do they do that online?
The easiest way would be to go to my website. The easiest way to remember, if you're driving somewhere right now and listening to Wave Farm Radio, would be to go to ericadawnlisle.info. My name is Erica with a C, ericadawnlisle.info. You'll see all the tour dates and ways to purchase things there.
Well, Erica, thanks for talking to me. It's been a lot of fun.
Thanks, Miriam. I really appreciate this.